And it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Asa Lee. Asa is the Associate Dean for Campus Life. I got it? Yep. Wesley. I always want to flip the L and the S. Wesley.
Thank you.
Visual aids are helpful.
I get nervous and then I know I'm going to do it. So this is Asa's second year serving on faculty in Bolden. And what we're most excited about is that he's planning to bring a group of students next summer. So we're very hopeful about that. So thank you, Asa.
Good morning, and happy to be with you all today, but also happy to be back in Holden. It's always a pilgrimage to come from Washington, D.C. to the Pacific Northwest, but specifically to Holden. But I think this is, as I shared with many and people last year, this is a unique place, as you all know. And so being a part of this learning community and this formative community is really exciting for me. What I want to do this week, is, and more specifically starting today, is to look at a very familiar figure, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. But for many of us, we have come to know him based upon the sainted status. And as one who grew up in a generation that never heard Dr. King on the television or on the radio or never heard in the pulpit, all we had was sort of the name and the figure. But it wasn't until graduate school when I began to actually move beyond the I Have a Dream speech to examine sort of the details of a theological vision that was much more radical than was ever fed to me in school books. So what I want us to do is sort of explore and re-examine his life. And so I've titled these three workshops as Rediscovering the Strength to Love, Examining Dr. King's Social Ethic. This session is the first of those, which looks at his idea of love and love as a way of sort of being the constant check of accountability on what's wrong in our society, and I would say societies, plural. So we're gonna go through and look at some very specific aspects, and I invite you to go deep, be challenged if you've been challenged, if you're going to be challenged. And then as we go along, if there are questions, I'm going to play Van White and go over and jot them down on the whiteboard and call them out as we need, and then hopefully I'll be able to sum those up as we go through our time today. So this first lecture is really an opportunity to get put on the lens of King and look at his conception of beloved community, which I think is a phrase that's overused. And so I think it's worth reclaiming his conception of beloved community, because now there are a lot of conceptions of beloved community out there that are worth critiquing. But for our purposes, we want to look at this specifically as King's conception, and then we're going to use a publication of his, The Strength to Love. This book was published in 1963, and if you have never read this, you should, because it feels like it's been published in 2019. And so, in many respects, King is often defined as a prophetic figure, and if a sign of the prophetic is that those words are timeless. You know, if we look at the prophet Isaiah and understand that the words that were spoken in the 6th century were still just as relevant as they were spoken then as now, King certainly meets that standard. And Strength to Love, I'll say more about it in a minute, is a way to understand his prophetic role in American life. So the source of this, the title of this series, in fact, Rediscovering the Strength of Love, is in fact rediscovering this. And so we're going to be looking at these concepts through this book, and we're going to have fun with it, I think. So, to begin, what do you know about this guy? Just call out some things. What do you learned? What did you know from school books, from your lived experience? What did you learn?
Preacher.
Yeah, preacher.
Preacher.
Controversial.
Controversial.
Charismatic.
Charismatic.
Pacifist.
Visionary.
Civil rights.
Civil rights.
Pacifist for the war.
Pacifist.
Flawed.
Great sense of humor.
Great sense of humor.
Nobel Peace Prize winner.
Nobel Peace Prize winner.
Martyr.
Didn't come looking to lead.
Martyr. Didn't come looking to lead.
Nonviolent protest.
Yeah. Nonviolent protest.
Studied with Gandhi.
Yeah. Right.
Spoke Smoker. Against poverty as well as racism.
Yeah. And spoke against poverty as well as racism.
Right.
Smoker. Yes. And drinker. And an avid pool player. Pool shark, actually. Pool shark.
Oh my gosh.
Fully human.
Fully human, yes.
Pursued by the FBI.
Yes.
Spoke about the Vietnam War.
Right.
Yeah. Spoke against the Vietnam War. Yeah.
Understood poverty versus wealth.
Yes. And privilege.
Privilege, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So here's some basic contrast goods. I mean, you've resisted the urge to believe just the schoolhouse story, right? Good. Born January 15, 1929, he was the son of a prominent and powerful Baptist preacher and pastor. He was born, here's a quick tidbit, they might know his birth name.
Michael.
His birth name was Michael. And he didn't have a middle name. His name was Michael King, Jr., named after his father. But after his father took a pilgrimage to Germany to walk in the steps of Martin Luther and discovered what a profound theologian, and he just was enamored by him, he came back and changed his name and his son's name to Martin Luther King.
Wow.
And so, so all of his childhood friends knew Martin Luther King as Mike. They called him Mike because he was like 7 or 8 when his name was changed. So, yeah, a little tidbit. Educated in Atlanta at Morehouse College, and then went to Crozer Theological Seminary, which is in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, and then received his PhD at Boston University, and went on to pastor 2 congregations, one in Alabama. In fact, he had not defended his dissertation when he was called to Dexter Avenue, so he was pastoring and writing his dissertation. And about 6 months after his dissertation was conferred, the Montgomery bus boycott started. So he was always, and he was a young man at that point, he was 22 when he started pastoring Dexter Avenue. So, and then from there he went to Ebenezer Baptist Church where his father pastored and became the co-pastor. Subsequent to his leadership of the civil rights movements in Montgomery, Alabama, and moving back to Atlanta, a group of African-American pastors got together and like-minded allies and formed the Southern Christian Leadership Council, and known as the SCLC. And it was the SCLC that was the primary entity for most of the civil rights mobilization in the late 50s and early 60s. And indeed up till his death in 1968. What we don't often hear, but kind of know instinctively, is he's a child of the segregated South, and so his experiences as a child of the segregated South in Atlanta certainly shaped his view of the world. He tells in his own words, in another one of his books, The Strive Toward Freedom, about his experience of playing with a white school-aged boy and immediately being told by that boy's parents that he's not allowed to play. And he ran home to kind of figure out from his parents what was going on, and that was his education. He was a primary school, and he instinctively knew that this was wrong, but didn't have the language to articulate it, which was a common practice, common understanding of African Americans in the South, of recognizing this barrier, not always having the capacity to figure out how to overcome it. The irony of that, though, is he's oppressed on one hand, but on the other hand, he's an upper class African American. His dad was the pastor of the most prominent church in Atlanta. And there are many stories of his family, not of wealth trumping Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. So there's a story told of Martin Luther King Sr. driving a car with young Mike in the back, and his father, in a hurry, turns up a one-way street in downtown Atlanta, mm-hmm. going the wrong way. The police immediately pull him over, and white officer walks up to the car and says, do you know what you did? And when the officer recognizes who driving the car, and Daddy King says, I'm the pastor of Ebenezer. Do you know who I am? The officer says, you drove a one-way street. And Daddy King says, I was only going but one way. And the officer says, Reverend King, don't do it again. And is allowed to pass. Certainly, that would have not been the case of many other African Americans in the city. So he grew up in a level of privilege that it takes later in life for him to realize. And some have argued that's where his understanding of the difference of wealth and privilege begins to come to bear, because he recognizes primarily his greatest critic early on is Malcolm X, who has grown up in urban environments in a very impoverished sense. And so he recognizes that and understands that his responsibility in part as a privileged African American is to then advocate for the underprivileged, not just in the African American community, but across the board. He's a Baptist minister, so he's not just a preacher, he's a Baptist preacher, so he has a very particularized view of the world, theologically speaking. And he's an academician in the sense that he's trained. So if you read his sermons, he is not just sort of articulating good gospel, he is advocating social gospel. And more, even more specific, a personalist view of Jesus and of the gospel. Okay, but uniquely in him, he's the first of a long line who's able to marry effectively the spirituality of the African American experience, rooted in hush harbors and in slavery, with a Western sense of Christianity, and meld the two, and bring it to the national scene. Surely there were others before him, folks like his mentor Howard Thurman, who bring an African-American spirituality to bear, but it is King who's able to link that with the fight for social justice. And that really is important, because that becomes the way in which his worldview gets expressed. And one of the primary ways in African-American spirituality that this gets expressed is a communal ethic through proclamation. So preaching is the primary means that the theological vision of Dr. King gets expressed. So the I Have a Dream speech is not a speech. It's a sermon. In actuality, the close of that, the I Have a Dream portion of that, was taken in part from a woman named Prethia Hall, who was one of the early black woman preachers in the Civil Rights Movement, who was a classmate of Dr. King. And they both shared this idea, and it is, as the legend goes, it was Mahalia Jackson sitting on the side of the speech who yelled out, mm-hmm. tell them about the preacher. Dream. Yeah. Tell them about the dream, right? Yeah. But it was a dream that was first rooted with Prethia Hall in seminary, mm-hmm. with the two of them. But it was a sermon. It wasn't a speech. And what we miss in the American discourse is that most of Dr. King's speeches are really sermons advocating a theological vision. And so when you go back and read the speeches, some of his most famous quote-unquote speeches, and you read them as sermonic texts, what you discover is that he's advocating a vision of the world that's rooted in his spirituality, right? So, in effect, that's what this is. The Strength of Love is published in 1963, of course, as the Civil Rights Movement is still, this is 2 years before the passing of the Voting Rights Act, and the Civil Rights Movement is very much a struggling movement, growing movement, to change the lives of the nation. of African-Americans and of white Americans. And so a publisher comes to him and says, you know, you've written a couple of books. By this time, Strive for Freedom had, been published, and a few other books had been published. And what the publisher asked for is, you've got this body of work of sermons, right? They need to be shared with the world. And what King writes in the beginning of the of Strength to Love is he didn't want to do it. Because sermons aren't meant to be in books.
That's right.
Sermons are meant to be lived, right? And so he says he's torn about, you know, I've got to rework these sermons because preaching them is not the same as writing them and putting them in a book. But he reluctantly does so. And what we get in this is a collection of about 15 different sermons, some of which are more famous than others, more familiar than others. But collectively, as I said, sermons convey a theological vision. And they also indict, right? They convict. A good sermon disrupts, right? What does it disrupt? It disrupts whatever normal sense of normalcy you might have. Right? If your sense of normalcy is that you're good and you're righteous and you're holy, none of the Lutherans in here were doing that, Baptists either, then the sermon would say, we have all sinned and fallen short, right? And it disrupts that reality. And so in the same way, this collection of work disrupts the sense of normalcy that the American experiment in American society and more broadly our own lives are without blemish or spot. And so with that, collectively, and this is now sort of my argument, what the Strength of Love offers is a definition of what it means to be in loving community with one another. Not just church, but broadly as a society, as a nation state, as a global community. What does it mean to really engage one another? And King adopts the language towards the latter half of his life as he's working through the theological implications of what does it mean to be in justice with each other. He adopts the language of Josiah Royce in coining the beloved community. Josiah Royce was a 19th century, early 20th century philosopher who wrote extensively against sort of a Nietzschean view of individualism, rugged individualism. That rugged individualism is what really matters and take the reins off of people and community and instead allow them to be their full self, right? The superhuman, the superman, for Nietzsche's language. Josiah Royce is an American philosopher who challenges that and says, no, the concept is not about individuality. The concept that is more common to humanity is community. That human beings first are born into and live through experiences of community before individuality. To know what it is to be an individual is first to understand what it is to be a part of a community. You cannot be an individual without being part of a community first. So Royce is the first one to articulate that, and what he says is that the community that is most pure is made up of individuals who are moving towards the same goal. And he coins the term a community of idealism, which later gets reworked to a beloved community. King reads about this in his doctoral studies and is fascinated by the idea, and later says, well, what are the ideals of a community like this? Justice, freedom, equality, right? And he then expands this to a notion that includes the fight for civil rights and social justice in America. So with that in mind, the core concept, unlike Josiah Royce, who believes that it's really a matter of everybody striving for a common idea, doesn't matter what the ideal is. King says the fundamental ideal of the beloved community is love. And it is love that becomes the standard, and it's the love that becomes the central organizing force in the community. However, it's not love in a sappy sense. And so when we read Strength to Love as a book, what we discover is that through these sermons and through a positing of a theological claim, there are four core concepts in love, in community, that become central and organizing. And it is these four concepts that we'll look at closely for the balance of our time today, but also over the next two consecutive days, we will explore more intimately. So these are four concepts that are in Strength to Love that come about more substantively that I want us to wrestle with, right, and unpack and explore. And I also think are the most relevant for us at this particular time in American history. As divided as we are, as frankly xenophobic as we are, and as, this is King's language, stupid as we are. Dr. King, in one of his sermons, I'll read it to you tomorrow, the title of the sermon is Love in Action. And he says, the fundamental problem of race in America, including slavery, is not evil. It's ignorance. Mm-hmm. And ignorance specifically, stupidity. Mm-hmm. And he goes through that. Now, that's the King I never read about. We never quoted that in school, but I love that kind of stuff, right? But we're going to look at these four concepts more intimately. But I want us to look at also some of his quotes that kind of encapsulate this. So the first quote. In his sermon entitled Loving Your Enemies, he says, love is the most durable power in the world. These are theological claims for us to engage. This creative force, so beautifully exemplified in the life of our Christ, is the most potent instrument available in mankind, humankind's quest for peace and security. This is the notion that love is the most consequential organizing principle in community. Again, it's a faith claim, right? So for him, that love, it's expressed in four distinct ways in community. So here are these four, right? We're going to keep going with these. First, love holds accountable. Second, love creates space for neighbor. Third, love is interdependent, not independent. And fourth, and I think this is the most challenging for us and also connects beautifully with the theme for this summer. Love and community embraces unity and difference as co-equals. Mm. And I think that's the one that we struggle with the most. All right. Let me pause before we go any further. Everybody with me? So first, love is accountability. This is from his sermon, Accepting Responsibility for Our Actions. What a novel title to a sermon. One of the most common tendencies of human nature is that of placing responsibility on some external agency for sins we have committed or mistakes we have made. We are forever attempting to find some scapegoat on which we cast responsibility for our actions. Now, here's the beauty of this sermon. It is, when you read it, it is as much a personal sermon as it is a corporate indictment. So that the human nature he's talking about is both our own individual capacity to say it was somebody else's fault, right? It's my 7-year-old's constant admonition that it's somebody else's fault that broke the lamp. It was my sister. It was, right? It's her personal sort of admonition. But it is also the collective, our societal and our communal implication that, oh, it was something else. Right? It was the fact that there was an external threat to the community that caused us to round up all of this group of people. Or it was a collective threat to all of us that caused us to decide that a certain group of people needs to not have access to wealth or power, mm-hmm. right? So, and to me, this kind of duality, which maybe he knew he was doing or maybe he didn't, is a sign of his own prophetic voice, right? And so, to me, this is sort of holds up the first notion of love being a verb and an act that requires us to hold one another accountable, right? And hold ourselves accountable. And I'll talk more about conformity in a minute, but what King, throughout his sermonic works, and he talks about it in this more specifically in a sermon entitled The Transformed Nonconformist, is that we have a propensity to want to get along, right? To be together, right? To be one who does not stand up in the boat to rock it. So we all sit down, and we all are quiet, and we resist the urge, even though we know that what is happening in the boat might be wrong, we resist the urge to call anyone to account. And that is not love. And it is damning to everyone in the boat. So the fact that we choose not to act or not to speak, in fact, condemns us all. And most significantly for King is, it is not love in the way that we want to soothe ourselves, right? For 23 years, I was serving parish ministry, 10 of those is in a pastoral role. The amount of times that I would say to congregants, why didn't you say something in the meeting?
Yeah.
And I have pastors in the room. You don't have to say yes. Right? After the meeting, you'd say, you know, we this got voted down, and this was an opportunity, so on and so forth. And they come after the meeting, like Nicodemus at night, and say, you know, Pastor, that was a really good idea, but, you know, you were right. But I just didn't feel like saying that, because these are my friends. Mm-hmm. I didn't have, I had more hair at the time, so I didn't. But that's what happens. Under the guise of love, we decide not to act, right? And what King is arguing is that's not love. And it's certainly not love in community, right? Love requires us to gently sometimes, and other times more forcefully, say, wait, stop, this is wrong, right? And this becomes more prominent in the civil rights movement, right? When folks say, well, just wait, and you know, time will come. Yeah. Well, when? Mm-hmm. Right? No, we won't wait. Right? And in some respects, this is exactly what is happening in many of our cultures and in our communities and in our microcultures and communities today. Whether it's the GLBTQIA issue, whether it's immigration, whether it is still race in America. We don't want the disruption of being held accountable. And if you would just get along and be quiet, right? So one of the, and so each of these bold questions are questions we're going to pick up, you know, but they're meant for you to sort of ruminate over. And that is, how do we exercise the loving practice of accountability, both for ourselves and for our communities? I'm not always an advocate of the first step being yelling and screaming at each other, right? There are like two or three, maybe five steps before you get to that point, but that should also be on the table. Yelling and screaming at each other may be a point if you are endangering my life, right? Second, here's another quote from King, titled On Being a Good Neighbor. Too seldom do we see people in their true humanness. A spiritual myopia limits our vision to external accidents. We see people as Jews or Gentiles, Catholics or Protestants, Chinese or American, Negroes or whites. And he's quoting, the sermon is coming from the parable of the Good Samaritan. The priests and the Levites saw only a bleeding body, not a human being like themselves. But the Good Samaritan will always remind us to remove the cataracts of provincialism from our spiritual eyes and see people as people. And so with that, it's a love that creates, love and community creates space for the neighbor, right? And what I find fascinating is whenever I talk about sort of the Good Samaritan, the neighbor, where you preach the sermon, it never fails. Someone comes up and says, asks the exact same question that the lawyer asked Jesus.
Who is my neighbor?
So who is my neighbor? So I just spent 20 minutes talking to you about it in the sermon and you didn't hear it. but in the sermon, what he really talks about is that we have the same problem as the lawyer, which is the question is not really a question.
Nope.
It's a smokescreen. Mm-hmm. Right? It's to say, I don't want to do this, so let me ask you another question. Mm-hmm. Right? Is if I can keep the question and answer thing going, then I never have to act. And so, at some point, as King articulates, is we have to come to grips with the fact that we have to act. We have to be willing to recognize that the admonition of Jesus in telling the parable of the Good Samaritan is that we are called to see one another as the traveler. That all of us, at one point in our lives or another, are the traveler on the Jericho Road. I'll let that sink in for a minute. Most of us read the Good Samaritan as the third party watching the interaction. But the parable is told, as are all parables, the parables are not stories that actually happen. They are, as we would say, if the parables were in a Greek context, we'd call them fables, right? Mm-hmm. But they are stories with wisdom that are told to tell a larger truth. So our point is, the point in telling the story is not for us to be a passive listener, but to actually place ourselves in the text. How do I know that? Because Jesus then asked the question of the lawyer, which one of these was a neighbor? Right? And so for us, it's the same notion, is that we are to place ourselves in the story. And no, we're not the priest. No, we're not the Levite. Sometimes we are the lawyer. But more often than not, at one point in our life or another, we're the traveler. And what's interesting is he first preaches this to the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, an African-American community, not a white community. And so he's actually getting them to recognize their own privilege in 1956. And I don't know if you've ever been to Montgomery, Alabama. It is about a 3-minute walk between the front door of Dexter Avenue and the Capitol steps of Montgomery Capitol Building. They're literally neighbors. And so the irony of this being preached at Dexter Avenue to African Americans who are under Jim Crow segregation, right? This is, again, sort of the theological vision and claim which indicts us all. And so we're all travelers on the journey. We're all, at one point or another, subject to robbers, to oppressive schemes. And we have to wrestle with that. We have to struggle with that, because then when it is our turn to be the priest or the Levite, are we going to walk away from a bloody body? Or are we going to stop long enough to recognize that they're human too? Community makes space for neighbor. It's one of my favorite sermons by Dr. King.
Yeah.
A Knock at Midnight. I actually use this when I'm teaching preaching courses to analyze sort of the mechanics of the sermon, which are just really, really powerful. Three simple points to the sermon. Right? This comes from the text. Which one of you would deny bread till your friend comes and knocks at midnight, right? There's three simple points to the sermon. One, there's a knock. No, one, it's midnight. Two, there's a knock. Three, you get bread. That's it. But here's a quote. At midnight, men, women, are all together. Where'd it go?
It's on your shoulder.
Okay. At midnight, men altogether are altogether ignored because of their limited education, or they are given bread that has been hardened by the winter of morbid class consciousness. Many people continue to knock on the door of the church at midnight after the church has so bitterly disappointed them because they know the bread of life is there. Again, this is a sermon preached at Dexter Avenue. And this sermon goes on to be one of his most popular sermons preached all over the world. And what he's a Baptist pastor. So for him, the beloved community is not just some moral idea, but it is an idea that is carried forth by the Christian church. And if the Christian church cannot get itself together, then how do we ever expect the beloved community to become realized? But midnight in the sermon is an existential reality, not just a time. Midnight is, he says, as a matter of fact, I'm just going to read it to you. It's just great. Forgive my excitement. No, don't forgive it. Just make room for it. At midnight, colors lose their distinctiveness and become a sullen shade of gray. Moral principles have lost their distinctiveness. For modern humanity, absolute right and absolute wrong are a matter of what the majority is doing. Right and wrong are relative to the likes and dislikes and the customs of a particular community. We have unconsciously applied Einstein's theory of relativity, which properly described the physical universe, to the moral and ethical realm. Midnight as an existential reality means we can do anything. There is no distinctiveness anymore. And what he argues is it's to the church that people run in that existential reality. Right? Although I would say that's probably a distinct difference between then and now.
Yeah.
That we don't run to the church. Because the church is a part of the moral gray. In many respects. And so to this sort of problem of gray, the shade of gray that we live in, is the distinctiveness of being in community with each other and depending on each other. So love and community is interdependent, not independent. I assume I don't need to define the difference. For kicks and giggles, I know. So, independent means I am myself apart from anybody else. I alone define who I am, and I alone grow into the fullness of who I am going to be. In our more contemporary language, it would be, I achieve my own success, and I therefore should be rewarded for all of that. Interdependent recognizes that while I'm a distinct individual, that individuality comes in and through the distinctiveness of someone else. It is the African principle of South African principle of Ubuntu. I am because we are. Right? I am the fullness of who I am when you are the fullness of who you are. Right? That's interdependence, interdependency. And the problem in the American experiment that Dr. King talks about is, or and even goes as far as say the sin of the American society, is that we have a dependency problem. We either exploit one another so that we can get self-gain, or we shun one another so that we can do it all by ourselves. And so we are either dependent to the zapping of someone's life energy, or we are independent in the sense that we'll do it all by ourselves, and for those of us who are pastoring, that leads to burnout. Not even pastoring, if you're doing anything, you need burnout. So we give too much of our power, our authority, and much of our lives over to some other entity. And we then rely on that thing to give us more that feeds us without ever returning something to that person. What he says instead is that it is the model of the triune God that gives us the model for community, which is interdependency. Complicated theological term called perichoresis, which simply says that each person of the Trinity is fully and a part that person, and yet together make up the whole of God. It's a both and. And so the image here is a wonderful image of dancing, that the partners are separate, but together they are the collective and one, yet they are two distinct partners. In community, love creates a space for you to be you and for me to be me, and together we are strengthened in our own identity and our collective identity. Bluntly, we have lost that in our broader society. We've just lost it. Some would say we deliberately walked away from it. But we no longer believe that the least of these can better the ones in the front of the line. At least outside of economics. But morally, we don't believe it anymore. And that's not anything new. King was talking about that in 1950s and 60s. So the question is, how can we live interdependently? How do we live interdependently? We're ones who are our neighbors who we may not ever come in contact with. How do we affirm their existence and in turn affirm our own? Lastly, from his sermon entitled Transform Nonconformist, many people fear nothing more terribly than to take a position which stands out sharply and clearly from the prevailing opinion. This sermon was first preached in like 1960. Long before punditry as we understand it now. The tendency of most is to adopt a view that is so ambiguous that it will include everything, and so popular that it will include everybody. The sin here is conformity. The sin here is, in a nutshell, conformity. That sameness and unity are the goals in conformity. If everybody can agree, if everybody looks the same, if everybody talks the same, then everything's fine and we are unified. But what the transformed nonconformist, what the sermon posits, is quite simply that there is a fundamental distinction between being unified and being different. And they are not opposites. You can be unified and different. Just like you can be disunified and the same in many other ways. And so what we have to learn to be able to do as a community, what love posits in community, is that we embrace unity and difference as equals, as co-equals in community. And I say this is hard because, big if the church is the place where the beloved community first realized, then most of our churches are monolithic, mm-hmm. right? Generally same age, generally same economics, generally same ethnicity, generally same theological outlook on these things, right? And on one hand, we could argue, a sociologist would argue, well, that's what a church is a social aggregation of people who have a like-minded cause and the theological vision, right? But if the church is the place where the beloved community is first realized, then that causes us to think carefully about the fact that everybody in my church looks the same. It comes from the same economic community. And I got to give some thought to that. Because if, as we heard last night in Vespers, God busts up the Tower of Babel because they got the same language and they got sort of the same call about being bigger and better than God, then our churches need to be the place where that difference is being realized. right? And that, but I also think that it's, this is where fear comes into play. If we get difference in our sameness, right, if it invades our identity, then I'm going to be required to change. Mm-hmm. And nobody likes change. I don't like change. But it is what happens. And so unity and difference are co-equals. You can be unified and you can be different. And the struggle is to figure out how to be unified in and over your difference. And so love allows for the unique expressions that differ from others, and we grow together over, in and over those differences. So how do we express unity through difference? That's the question for us to wrestle with. So here are the four questions. And that's it. This was hard in my own mind planning this, because this is pretty jolting in the sense that this is a voice echoing from, 4 to 6 years ago, right? And screaming to us, which means we haven't changed very much. So let's talk. We got some time. Let's talk fast. What do you think? We're going to wrestle with these tomorrow. One more intimately. Yeah?
Can I go a little bit off topic?
Sure.
Because there's a strain of thought that lays independence at the feet of Luther, because of the priesthood of all believers, which was obviously a product of unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. So, in a sense, where do we as Lutherans kind of own up to that and correct that, or is there to get us back to an interdependent sense of thought? I mean, you have some.
Yeah, I think there is a clear distinction between the kind of control that I think Luther is speaking against, right? That the Catholic Church,
right,
sort of controlling the narrative, and that the priesthood of all believers recognizes there are things that are given by the grace of God that are not mediated by the Catholic Church or the priest, but instead are available to us through, because we're justified. And I don't think that directly speaks to independence as much as it speaks to an opportunity, right? So I think independence is a choice. Rugged individualism is a choice, right? It's not a direct consequence. If you decide to walk away from the communities that have shaped you, to then deny any role in them shaping you, that's a choice, right? And here's the thing, my area is Christian formation and leadership studies. Whether or not that formation and that growing up was positive or negative, it has shaped you, right? Whether your family upbringing has been an impactful and meaningful motivation in your life is without question, because it's either shaped you in a way that has caused you to be one way and say, I lean to my father on this and this and the other thing, or another way that says, my father was abusive and so therefore I am not, right? That has shaped who you are. The choices you make about that are yours to make, and I think many times we think that, I'm a strong advocate that we always, as I was sharing with Glenn and some others at the table, that I strongly reject binaries, right? I strongly rejected binaries, that, it's either this or that, right? I rarely think that we are faced with a this or that proposition, unless, at the end of the day, you either are going to live or die. That's the ultimate thing. But most of the things we convince ourselves that are binaries, that we either have to do this or we have to do that, I think we need to tarry a bit longer and seek discernment, because there's a third way always available to us in Christ. I don't know if I answered what you're saying.
No, but you just opened it all up.
Boom.
Which is good for me.
Okay.
I don't know about the rest of the
others. Yes.
I'm thinking about one of your earlier points about speaking up and how hard that is, because we don't tend to get trained in it. And it makes me think about how I think that needs to be maybe something the church starts doing for people. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about my son in Kung Fu as a six-year-old who used to say, don't hit. But if you're little and kids are beating on you, you don't quite know what to do other than hit back. Mm-hmm. I think we're in kind of a similar situation in a grown-up way. Racism exists. We don't like it. What do we do? What are the tools? How do you have an open conversation? How do you have an uncomfortable conversation? How do you get empowered to challenge somebody else so it's not just a fight?
Mm-hmm.
And like in Kung Fu, there are all these steps. And his teacher, his Sifu, sat down with him and said, before you start using Kung Fu, here are some things you can do. And the kids would practice that regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And so it became part of what they did. And then he said, so now this thing called Kung Fu, it's kind of like the vacuum in the cupboard. If there's a mess, you bring out the vacuum and then you clean it up. And then you put it back. You don't stay with your vacuum all the time.
Right.
That's not needed. So it's just a thought that I'm having. But like, if we really want to transform things, I think we need help beyond just the inspirational words, but also just more emphasis put on how do you have a conflict with people? Because that's not comfortable for most of us.
Correct.
We think of it as an immediate fight.
There's a difference between confrontation and conflict.
Mm-hmm.
I tell a lot of my students this all the time, is that for most of us, we're conflict averse, and therefore we don't confront. Mm-hmm. But there's a fundamental difference between confronting and conflict. If you step on my toe, I'm going to confront you. I'm going to say, you stepped on my toe. That's a confrontation.
Or please get off.
Yeah. If I push you off,
mm-hmm.
we're in conflict,
mm-hmm.
right? And for many of us, what we don't say anything because we're scared of conflict.
Yes.
But the problem, as King lays out, is you never hold anybody accountable to anything if you're concerned about always somebody jumping down your throat. Right? And this is the American problem. This is uniquely an American problem in our centuries-long issue with white supremacy.
Yeah.
But what I often use as a parallel example is the Me Too movement, and that women have found their voices to be able to speak, which makes men uncomfortable. So what? So what? As a heterosexual male, cisgender heterosexual male, I should be made to feel uncomfortable. Right? So hearing my mother tell her Me Too story shattered my understanding of both my mother as well as my own sense of my male identity. That's a good thing. Because as a father of all girls, I then will empower them to use it. You see? In the same way, race has to be confronted in the same way, which means you have to first start with yourself, right? And if you have to be willing to sit in a level of uncomfortability. And if Uncle Joe has always been the one to say sideways things out of his mouth,
yeah.
Right, and I'm using Uncle Joe because when I've done race trainings in the past, people refer to an uncle.
Yeah.
If Uncle Joe's been the one that grew up in some place where he just was adamant and this, that, and the other thing, then at what point during family dinner are you going to finally say, Uncle Joe, can you stop that, please? Not conflict.
Mm.
It's confrontation. Now, if Uncle Joe wants to escalate it, then you may have to leave. Some of you in here had to leave family members and not talk to them since 2016.
Yeah.
Right? For one way or another. But to me, I don't see that as a bad thing. it's disappointing that relationships break apart. But accountability means that we sometimes have to look at each other in the face and say, we cannot be together and me allow you to keep continue to say these things. That's what's hard. But I think the key to this is, it is not my responsibility to continue to bear that weight. As the only African American in the room, I will say, it is y'all's responsibility to bear that weight. And to feel that same pain.
And then it's a choice.
And then it becomes a choice, precisely, right? But if you're committed to change, then the choice has to be made. Now, how you do that is up to you and your own lived experience, right? One, two, and three, yeah.
What, you mentioned individualism, and I mean, as long ago as de Tocqueville, he was very worried about that America was the great expression of equality and liberty, but he worried about our excessive emphasis on what he called, individualism, mm-hmm. that it would run amok and destroy the others, mm-hmm. liberty, equality, and fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes within the church even, we stress individualism to a point that destroys the others, the other aspects of the beloved community.
Mm-hmm.
When we say, well, that person is, of course, entitled to his or her belief. And there were some old books that, like Habits of the Heart, mm-hmm. brought that out. Remember that? I don't know which of us are old enough to remember that, but there was this character in Habits of the Heart named Sheila, and she finally said, well, I guess I would boil my belief system down to Sheilaism.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I believe, and I don't need to express it in any other way. That is excessive individualism.
The irony, not to cut you off, but the irony is that in the 21st century, of public American identity,
right.
It is a falsehood to believe that we are ruggedly individualistic when most of our life is aggregated in
life.
In some sort of way, right? So we either are a part of a political party, right? Or we're part of an ideological group, or we all watch Fox News or MSNBC or CNN, or we've shunned all the news networks, right? So we're living in these groups.
In groups.
In silos, right? So it's a dual narrative that's happening. And we've got to struggle with that, because some of that is conformity.
Yep.
And some of that is an acknowledgement that we are not as individualistic as we would like that we would say we are. We're being led a certain direction. Yeah. But you're bringing up a good point about de Tocqueville's concerns for us. Yeah.
I was thinking about how community in some places enables racism.
Absolutely.
What I did not tell you at lunch the other day is that I grew up in Alabama. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah. What part?
I grew up in Sullivan, which is about an hour north of Tuscaloosa.
Okay, yeah.
So I've watched community, including the church, enable racism to thrive
mm-hmm.
there.
Mm-hmm.
In as much as, so I wonder if you can say something about what we do in cases where community is at the root of the disease.
Yes, I'll use a very simple historical narrative, right? Most of us have been taught that the South, in Civil War, the South was the reason why slavery existed and was perpetuated, and the war was fought for slavery. That is without question. And so we don't see the fact that the North was in some ways more complicit in the perpetuation of slavery.
Economically.
Because of the single reason that the greatest export of the United States in the 19th century, or pre-Civil War, was cotton. Globally. That most Northernist ships were built because of this. There was a panel, I don't know if anybody watched, I think you should, it's on C-SPAN, the reparations testimony. C-SPAN. So there's a woman, the only white woman on the panel, whose family, she discovered in her 20s, was the greatest perpetuator of and ex-importer of slaves in American history.
Ooh.
Her family was from Rhode Island.
Oh.
They built the ships that hauled the bodies from Africa to America, to the Americas, to the tune of about 12,000 human beings. White woman, prominent white family, Rhode Island, not in the South. First step is to tell the story, is to recognize that the community is a lot more complex than the narrative that they've told themselves, right? In every single American community, there are narratives that have not been told. And all you gotta do is ask, what happened to so-and-so? Oh, we don't talk about that. Start there. And I think churches are the primary place, and as pastoral leaders, say what you want about the decline of mainline Protestantism, of all of the institutions that are trusted in the American public life, pastors in the church are still higher than most, right? The only thing that's a little bit higher than pastoral church leaders are the military in shared public life. The recent Pew study, I think 2016, I have to find the most recent one, but you know, when Congress is 8%, pastoral leaders being 40% is really good, relatively speaking, right? So you as congregations and pastoral leaders going into your communities and unearthing facts, right? If you go to the National Museum of African American History, the new museum in Washington, D.C., on the second floor of the museum is a genealogy lab where you can kind of do research. One of the families that's profiled in that in the Smithsonian, it's a permanent exhibit, is a prominent family that was in my congregation that I served. They traced most of their heritage back to the Mount Vernon, and they were descendants of the slaves of Mount Vernon. And that community that they grew up in and were freed was a place called Freedman's Village, which now exists where the National Airport and the Pentagon sit, right? They were all slaves that were freed from the Custis Plantation, which was the big house where Arlington National Cemetery is. That was the Custis Plantation, right? Some of y'all, I'm telling you history you didn't know, right? The Custis Plantation was donated after the Civil War to the federal government to start what became Arlington National Cemetery. There were slaves there to the tune of about 300. They were freed, and they didn't have any place to go, so they went down the hill to the flatlands of the Potomac River and started a community called Freedman's Village. It existed from 1865 to 1939 when the federal government seized it en masse to build the Pentagon without pay. My church that I served was born in that community. I had a member of my congregation who was 96 years old. She joined the church when she was 8. Whose mother and grandmother raised her in Freedman's Village for a time. She sat down with me at her kitchen table and drew a map from memory of Freedman's Village. Right? And then sat and told me the stories of the community and who the good people were and what happened and the racial division and all these other kinds of things. That was sitting in my congregation right there. Right? So, I mean, your communities are already there, and they know the history. My wife, who served as a Methodist pastor, served a congregation. She was the first person in 160 years to serve the two Methodist churches in our northern Arlington County. One was a historically African-American church. The other was a white church, historically white church. The white church was a Union hospital. That's how old it was, in Virginia. It was a Union hospital and a Union cemetery. She was the first African-American clergy person in 2012. The church existed since 1850-something. Oh. The first African-American clergy person, right? She served there for 2 years. A mile and a half away is another Methodist church that was founded by African-American slaves and was also Methodist, and the bishop moved her to that church. She was the first person in the mutual history of both churches to be in both places. You know what she discovered? Because he always wondered why the African-American church never came down to the white church. They never associated with each other, ever. So when she finally took the opportunity to discover both, you know what she discovered? Well, let me give you a third part of the story. In Arlington County, in 1960, as a response to the encroaching African-American presence of homeownership in Arlington County, in liberal Arlington County, a wall was erected between two communities, like literally in the backyard. And it rent for about a mile and a half, and it was a 6-foot, it's a 12-foot wall, actually. It's a story in the Post, the Washington Post, last summer, about this is not, you know, the wall at Southern Border, it's not the first wall we tried to build, there's a wall in Arlington County. That wall was meant to separate the white folks from the encroaching presence of African-American homeowners. When my wife started trying to do racial conversations between two churches, you know what she discovered? The director of planning for the county, who was a beloved saint of the white church, was the architect of the wall. Now that church, that white church, is a liberal, sort of progressive, a reconciling Methodist community, who would have been devastated to hear that. And you know what happened? The pastors who met with her and talked about, you know, this, when she told them that story and said, in my African-American community, the vilified name is John Doe. When they heard that, all the conversation stopped. Too intense. How do we confront? How do we hold accountable? How do we tell this story? You know, this person is buried in the church cemetery. He's a saint of the community. It's the same guy who built the wall to perpetuate the segregation of the community. Right? As pastors, you have to be willing to pastor people through that hard lesson. They called me and said, what do you think we should do? I said, show them a picture of Dr. King smoking. Right? Everybody's human.
Yep.
They make mistakes. And so we got to be willing to wrestle with that as a community. So telling the story becomes really important so that you can move.